Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, how bad has this year's tornado season been? The answer, by all accounts, is extraordinarily bad, even by historical standards. The storms just keep coming. At least 13 people were killed during a series of storms that struck portions of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Arkansas just in the last day and a half, including a tornado that killed 5 people near Oklahoma City. The storm started on Tuesday. They didn't let up until early Wednesday. And of course, that's on the heels of the horrific storm that virtually destroyed a good chunk of Joplin, Missouri. That death toll rose to 125 after an overnight search turned up more bodies, but no new survivors. We've also had the whole sweep of storms that hit the southern part of the United States not very long ago. And we now are up to more than 480 people, which is the highest death toll since 1953, when an outbreak of twisters across the Midwest and the Northeast claimed 519 lives. And this, despite the fact that we do have early warning systems in place throughout the tornado country. Why have we seen so many horrific tornadoes causing such destruction and death? That's the question of this hour, and we'll have two guests with us. Paul Markowski is joining us the first half hour of the first hour, associate professor of meteorology at Pennsylvania State University. Later, we will speak with the president of the Center for Severe Weather Research in Boulder, Colorado. Welcoming your phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that's open to you as well. That is talk@wpr.org. Professor Paul Markowski, thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you? You've been
okay.
Rather busy, I would imagine. Tell me, the big question of the hour is, why in the world have we seen such horrifically devastating tornadoes one after another? Do we know what's going on?
Well, we could chew up probably the whole hour talking about some aspects of that broad question. In short, there have been, in the last 2 weeks, it's been a really active pattern. By active pattern, what I mean is there have been a lot of storms tracking across the central United States and areas where there's a lot of instability in the same place where there's wind shear. And instability is just a general term that meteorologists use to describe the tendency for air to rise because it's warmer than its surroundings. And shear is a technical term that just refers to how much the winds change with height. And when you have a lot of shear together where there's a lot of instability, you get tornadoes potentially. So There's been a lot of overlap in those two parameters recently. But, you know, up until about mid-April, which was when there was that round of nasty weather in the southeastern United States, we had actually been running below the 5 to 10 year average for tornadoes. So it's really only recently that things have gotten very crazy.
People are asking the question whether or not it's related to a warming of the planet, if climate change has anything to do with this. Would you agree that the jury is pretty much out on that at this point?
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. There are some aspects. I mean, climate change is a fairly robust finding. Some of its consequences are pretty straightforward. For example, if the Earth gets warmer, ice melts, and the sea level rises, that's pretty much a slam dunk. But other things are much more complicated, and tornadoes are one of those. There are two big problems with tornadoes that make it really hard to see where things are headed. One is that it's hard for us to even see the trend in tornadoes. We need probably a few thousand years of good tornado data, which we don't have anything like that at all. With temperature records, we have hundreds of years of records and even thousands of years if you can use proxy data. But with tornadoes, our record, first off, it's not even worldwide. It's really limited to the United States. That's really the place where the reports are half trustworthy. And even reporting issues aside, there's just a lot of year-to-year variability. Some years we might only have 500 tornadoes, and another year there's upwards of 1,500. So that all that variability makes it hard to see the trend unless you have a really big data set, and our data are just really limited. And the other big issue, just that just speaks to kind of the vagaries of tornado reports. That reports have certainly increased, but the actual numbers nobody really thinks are changing that much. The reason for that is that the reports have gone up exponentially, but the reports of strong to violent tornadoes really haven't changed in the past 50 years. But the other big issue is that with tornadoes, I mentioned this need to have instability and shear in the same places. And we know that instability, or I should say, there's some hints that instability is probably going to increase on a warmer Earth. But there are also suggestions that shear is going to decrease. So with tornadoes, we've got these two competing effects. It's not really clear which one's going to win. And in fact, there's certainly reasonable arguments that could be made that the shear is more important. So weakening of the shear could actually mean less tornadoes in the future. But all things considered, there's just way too much uncertainty. It's really, we really have no idea where things are headed with respect to tornadoes in a future climate.
Have we seen a big shift in population centers in the past 50 years? So there are more people in paths where perhaps they shouldn't be living, or they should be living in extremely strong houses.
Well, there's always been a trouble. This is part of the reason for the rise in tornado reports, is that there are fewer really desolate areas left in the United States. You can certainly find some in the central U.S., but people have cameras now on their phones and camcorders, and there's storm chasers. A lot of that activity has been glamorized on TV, and this has driven reports up in a big way. As far as population centers being closer to tornado activity where there weren't any years ago, I'm not quite so sure that's the case. I mean, if you look back at some of the bad historical tornadoes, I mean, Dallas has been hit hard in the past century. Omaha has been hit hard. I mean, there have always been cities in the so-called Tornado Alley that have been hit hard. So I'm not sure. I mean, tornado fatalities have actually been decreasing for the past century up until that decrease has probably leveled off in roughly the last 10 years or so. And then there have been these, this year has been horrific. I don't know what, I think you mentioned the death toll at the beginning of the
yes.
show. It's on the order of hundreds at this point, which is extremely anomalous. We had the bad event in Joplin, Missouri just a few days ago. That was not a big tornado outbreak. There were only a couple of tornadoes that night, but one was just in a particularly bad place. It hit a population center. So I think a lot of that is just tied to the randomness of intrinsically rare events.
Mm-hmm.
The analogy I like to use with some of my students is if you park your car under a tree in which there are birds nesting and leave the car there for a month, you're going to find bird droppings scattered randomly all over the hood of the car. And you can probably find places on the hood where droppings, there's three or four of them within a really small area, and other areas of the hood that haven't really seen anything, and maybe some areas where droppings have landed on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of use that as an analog for the tornado frequency. There's some places that have been hit multiple times in the past decade. That doesn't necessarily mean that those people have certainly not done something wrong to piss off the gods, or that there's some trailer park attracting the tornadoes, or some other terrain feature that's attracting them. It's just part of the intrinsic randomness of the phenomenon.
Are these different kinds of tornadoes? What we saw in Joplin, what we're seeing in Oklahoma, is there something, are they two tornadoes in one, or are they just your average tornado?
The Joplin tornado is extremely high-end. I believe that I've heard that it's been rated what's called EF5, which
yes.
is the highest rating that can be assigned. And some of the tornadoes in Oklahoma yesterday are probably going to be, look like some of the damage was certainly in the EF3 to EF4 range. So that's very high-end. I mean, there have been some 10-year stretches where we only have one or two tornadoes like that in a 10-year period, and then there have been other outbreaks where we have two or three of those in one day. So again, this speaks to there's a lot of variation from year to year in the tornado count. which makes it really hard for us to see what the long-term trend is, which makes it then hard to draw conclusions about not just where the climate of tornadoes has been coming from, but where it might be headed in the future.
Right. Is there a way, looking at those videos from Joplin, there was just nothing left. It was amazing, the destruction. Was there a way to build a house? Is there a way to build a house that's completely tornado-proof?
That's a fantastic question. As a scientist, it's been very frustrating to see all of these tornado casualties because the work that scientists do is to try to better understand these things and hopefully improve warnings. All things that I've heard is that the warning has been fantastic, but the loss of life has still been very tragic. So, yeah, it makes you wonder. I don't think we know yet exactly where all the fatalities have been. Were they people basically doing everything they've been told to do, and it just didn't matter because the event was so extreme? I don't know that we know that yet, but yeah, a lot of the damage I've seen, it looks as if the tornado probably would not have been survivable unless you were really below ground or in what's called a safe room, which is a concrete reinforced room. If you don't have a basement, you can have one of these built. People usually have them serve as closets, but basically the walls are steel reinforced concrete. And I saw one aerial shot from Oklahoma yesterday where the house was gone, but the safe room was actually still standing. So I don't think you can build a house that's completely tornado proof, but you can. These safe rooms are engineered structures. I believe the cost is on the order of $5,000 to have it installed in your home. Maybe it's a little less than that if you have it put in when the home's being built in the first place, just because it's a bit easier to do it at that stage. But So the short answer is I don't think you can make a house completely tornado-proof, but you can probably make some parts of it practically tornado-proof.
And yet you wonder how many people will do that because we all think it's never going to hit us.
That's right. I mean, in any location on Earth, even a place like Tornado Alley, tornadoes are extremely rare phenomena. I mean, a place like Central Oklahoma, which is probably has the highest tornado risk of anywhere on the planet, even there, the recurrence interval of a 200-mile-per-hour wind is a couple thousand years. So, yes, if you're doing the trying to assess the cost-benefit equation, the rarity of the event makes it really hard to even say I'm going to spend the $5,000 here. But
right.
I mean, when you are talking about potentially saving lives, that factors into the equation too, and maybe that then does make it worth it.
We certainly welcome your phone calls, and let's start taking them as soon as you'd like to call in. Our guest is Professor Paul Markowski, Associate Professor of Meteorology at Pennsylvania State University. We're talking about these horrendous and deadly and extremely destructive tornadoes that we've been seeing this tornado season. Just this week, of course, the one that really destroyed parts of Joplin, Missouri, and killed 125 people. And then we had more tornadoes yesterday, striking portions of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Arkansas. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls. Frank in Madison, our first caller. Hello, Frank. Hi, Frank. Are you there? Well, we'll put Frank on hold. I'm not sure where he is. I think everything's working here. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. And the email address for you to send in question that way is talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Bob in Duluth. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Yeah, I've never heard of tornadoes occurring anywhere but in the United States, and I was wondering if they occur in other countries, and if so, how strong do they get there?
That's a good question. Tornadoes have actually occurred on every continent of the Earth except Antarctica, at least as far as we know. And but you're right, the United States by far sees the worst share. There are some other local hotspots worldwide. One is in southeast China, another is in Bangladesh. Another is in extreme southern Brazil, but those are relative hot spots, but they are still nowhere near as active as, say, the Kansas to Oklahoma to Nebraska Central Plains region.
And tell us again, you talked about the instability and the wind shear. Is it more than that that makes these areas hot spots?
Well, the reason why those areas are hot spots, they also are those places are places where the shear and instability tend to be high and where they tend to overlap. In other words, both are kind of in phase. The instability is high at the same time the shear is high. The, worldwide, those areas tend to be near warm bodies of water and downwind of major mountain ranges. So in the United States, the Central Plains area is north of the Gulf of Mexico, which is an extremely warm body of water. It's actually the warmest body of water at that latitude anywhere on the Earth. And the Rocky Mountains, obviously, are a major mountain barrier to the west. And I mentioned Bangladesh. Bangladesh is north of the Bay of Bengal, which is similarly warm, and it's downstream of the Himalayas. So anywhere where you can find kind of those parameters, big terrain to the west and a warm body of water to the south, you can usually find these instability and shear parameters coming together. But Tornado Alley in the United States is that just happens on a really big scale, and that's one reason why Tornado Alley is named as it is.
Hmm. Thank you for the call, Bob. Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank. Are you there?
Hello, yes.
Hi, Frank. Go right ahead.
I'd like to ask if there's anything unusual about the incubation conditions, that create the incubator for tornadoes. Is the Gulf of Mexico warmer this year? Does La Nina have anything to do with whether or not we have colder air from the west? And is there a particularly stable situation that might be generating more tornadoes? Or perhaps the science is such that it's what you suggest, that this is a stochastic thing. We're getting more, but it's random. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Frank.
Yeah, there's definitely a very large stochastic component. Whether the Gulf of Mexico is a little warmer this year than in other years, actually, I have to admit, I didn't do my homework. I don't know if that's actually true or not. I have seen some past studies where people have tried to relate Gulf of Mexico water temperatures to tornado activity, and there's not a very good correlation between any single magic parameter and tornado activity, which speaks to the complexity of tornadoes. There's multiple factors involved, which is why people don't really make seasonal outlooks of tornadoes, because there's such low confidence. And the same thing goes for La Nina, El Nino. Those sorts of global scale anomalies certainly can be related to some aspects of United States weather, but tornadoes just seem to depend on so many things coming together. They're such local phenomena, such short-lived, transient, although intense phenomena. It's very hard to just point the finger at one or two magic parameters and say, if that parameter goes up this season, then we're going to have more tornadoes. If that parameter goes down, then we'll have fewer tornadoes. There's just too many things that have to come together and superpositioning of all of these things.
Paul, how much warning do you have, or how much knowledge do you have when you look at a really bad sky? You got a bad storm, you got the instability and the wind shear. How many minutes or seconds does it take as you're examining that sky to see a tornado form? How long do you think it'll take before it might happen? Or you know it's going to happen?
If you're observing a storm from your house, watching an approach, largely a function of how fast the storm's moving. Some storms move 50, 60 miles an hour. So in that case, you might go outside and see a scary-looking sky, and you literally might only have seconds to a minute to make a decision about what you're going to do about it, which is hopefully to get inside it and either get underground or put as many walls between you and the outside of your house as possible if you don't have a basement. In other situations, some of these events we've had recently, the storms, some people had up to an hour's warning, and the sky probably looked threatening for a while as the storm approached. And it's strangely, it's ironic, or I should say it's tempting to wonder in some cases whether there can be too much lead time on some of these events where you're under a tornado warning for an hour or two, and you're wondering, okay, it still hasn't happened yet. Is it ever going to happen? And you let your guard down a bit. I don't think we know the answers to these questions yet, but I guess I'm at least throwing out the potentially controversial question, which is more lead time always better, or is there an optimal lead time of, say, 15 minutes, but then maybe more than that is not so productive? I think it's hard to say, and it probably depends exactly on your user. A hospital, for example, probably needs a lot more lead time to move patients than you would want, perhaps, if you're in your house, where it maybe just takes you a few seconds to get to the basement.
We go to Dan in Campbellsport. Hi, Dan.
Ah, good morning. Hey, my question is in regards to relative size of tornadoes, and sometimes you hear these things being described as like 3/4 to a mile wide. And I'm just wondering, is that the actual funnel size, or is that more the actual whole rotating cloud that's sort of described that way?
It can be either. Some tornadoes actually do have a mile-wide funnel, and those are the ones that they're rare, but they do happen, and they're usually the really high-end extreme tornadoes. Other storms have much narrower funnels, but they certainly, if you're within even a mile of the narrow funnel, it's still going to be windy at your location. It's not as though you step across that funnel boundary and you go from extreme winds to nothing. It's pretty darn windy if you're near a tornado, even if you're not in the funnel. It's not quite like the movie Twister, where the tornado approaches and there's practically no wind outside that tornado, and you step across the funnel's boundary, and inside that is where all the extreme winds are occurring.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, sure. Dan. Mallory in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. This professor in physics on Fox News is stating like there's almost going to be a Y2K in 2012 with the sun disruption in the magnetic poles. And I was wondering, does the sun have anything to do, like, I know there's sun storms and stuff, does that affect anything, you know, and if it does, how long does it take? Is it a cycle thing, or is it like a day or a week, or...
Yeah. Well, the sun is crucially important on the most basic level for getting storms, because it's the sun that heats the ground, and then the ground in turn is what warms the bottom of the atmosphere and generates this instability that I mentioned before as being one of the crucial ingredients for thunderstorms. But as far as long-term trends in the intensity of the sunlight go, there's really no evidence that plays any role. And even if it did play a role, we don't have the our tornado records and statistics are not good enough for us to even detect any effect, even if there really was one.
And I have one more question. Do you guys have a machine like on that movie where they, you know, actually took something at a tornado to measure everything?
Yeah, we don't quite have something like that. What we have actually in some ways is quite a bit better. We typically use radars, which are sending pulses of information back and forth at the speed of light. So we're actually getting, we can sample the whole storm, which is about 1,000 cubic miles. I mean, that's a lot of area or volume if you think about it. The storm, let's say, is roughly 10 by 10 by 10 miles in size. It's 1,000 cubic miles. We can sample that in about a minute, which is much better sampling than you could ever achieve with those balls that they used in the movie Twister that would float up into the sky. Anyway, it's an interesting idea. There might be some technologies down the road we can use kind of along those lines, not really balls, but in the nanotechnology area, they're developing smaller and smaller things all the time, and there might be basically microscopic dust particles we can use to trace things. But this is way ahead of things. This is probably 10, 20 years down the road at least. It's kind of fantasy land, science fiction of tornado research.
But considering the fact that more people are dying from these severe tornadoes and the damage has been so awful, do you imagine that we're going to move ahead more rapidly on that kind of research that would result in some help?
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a loaded question, obviously, given the state of things on a national scale with respect to funding of science. Yeah, funding has been flat or decreasing in time, so we'll just I'm not sure how that's going to go. Obviously, as horrific as tornadoes are, and nobody likes to see tornado casualties, there's certainly other national priorities as well, or even, I mean, if you think about in the medical research area, lots more people die from illnesses and that sort of thing. So I certainly can't say that tornadoes should be the number one priority of all science research, but certainly that's my area of expertise, and I would certainly welcome more interest and support of funding that sort of work.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure.
Our guest, the first part of this hour, Professor Paul Markowski, Associate Professor of Meteorology at Pennsylvania State University. Continuing our conversation, Joshua Werman is joining us next, President of the Center for Severe Weather Research in Boulder, Colorado. He is one of those people who does chase the storm and has equipment and people he takes to various tornado locations all over the country. He's traveled thousands of miles looking at these storms and trying to understand them better. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him as we continue our conversation about these horrendous storms. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Joshua Werman, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure. Good morning.
Yeah, thank you. Now, you're one of these people who actually goes real close to these storms, don't you? You kind of follow them?
Yeah, I'm a tornado researcher, and I lead a team that follows these storms, tries to surround them with weather radars, with instrumented vehicles, and also drop instruments in the path of the tornadoes.
That's kind of dangerous, isn't it?
Well, actually, our risk of getting killed by the tornado is probably pretty low. I mean, they're relatively small, and we have we're just experts in this. I mean, we've been near a lot of tornadoes, and we also have some of the best safety equipment in the world. We've got these Doppler radars that can see where the tornado is and how it's moving. So we've intercepted over 170 tornadoes, and we've never had an injury or certainly lost a vehicle or a person.
170 tornadoes, my goodness. You've been on the road,
yeah.
Sir.
Well, we drive a lot of miles every year. This year we're actually not doing as much as we usually would because we have so much data from the previous 2 years. But last year, for example, we were participating in the largest tornado study ever. Basically, all the tornado scientists in the country got together and did a project called Vortex 2. And we had 50 vehicles and about 100 scientists and students surrounding these storms. And we collected data in dozens of storms and literally dozens of terabytes of data also. And now all these scientists and their graduate students are sitting there pouring through that data, doing research, writing papers, writing their PhD dissertations, all the usual science activities in the lab.
What do you want to learn from all of that data?
Well, we're midway in the process of learning things. I get asked that question a lot. Even the week after we got the data, I was asked, what did you learn? what we're trying to do is really learn the very subtle differences between thunderstorms that make tornadoes and thunderstorms that don't. And they're quite subtle. If they were obvious differences, then we wouldn't be out here trying to study it. We could just see it. So we really were not expecting to go out and get data and then the next morning say, aha, now I know how tornadoes form. What we have to do is basically look through this data, which is, as I mentioned, terabytes and terabytes, but it's a lot of radar data, which collects three-dimensional images of the storms as they're forming, and then what we call thermodynamic data, which is temperatures, relative humidities, from vehicles that are driving around under the storms, from these tornado pods we drop in front of the storm, in front of the tornado, really trying to understand why some of those storms made the tornadoes and others didn't. Is it temperatures around the tornadoes, temperatures or relative humidities? Is there something to do with heavy precipitation in certain areas? Are there certain wind features that are helping concentrate the rotation as the tornado forms and intensifies? And we know these are hard questions to answer because we've been trying to answer them for about a decade, and that's why we did this hugely ambitious Vortex 2 project. And we anticipate it's going to take one, two, or three more years, really, before the important conclusions come out of this project and then get vetted by other scientists and get published in scientific journals. And then we know more about tornado formation. And then the really complicated part is how to make that into a forecast, basically how to improve a forecast based on that new knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Are you studying right now why this year we have seen so many very deadly tornadoes?
Well, one thing that we don't know is, or we can't link it to, is anything to do with climate change. This has been a very unusual year. There have been a lot of tornadoes. It's a record year, but frankly, it's not that much above the previous record pace. So while it's an unusual year, it's not wildly unprecedented. What has been unusual is that so many of these have hit cities and towns, and obviously the number of deaths is very unusual, and it's more people than have died in many decades. I'm going to pause for a second, but you've actually caught me in a car because yesterday we did tornado missions, and today we are damage surveying in some of the areas where we got radar data. So we're pulling up right now to a area which has some tornado damage, not severe tornado damage. It looks mostly like a lot of trees have been knocked down. Fortunately, it doesn't look like Joplin, Missouri, but we have radar data in the storm that did this. So
where are you?
Trying to compare.
Where are you?
We are in Guthrie, Oklahoma.
Oh, you are. So you're on a job as we speak. What was the previous record pace for tornadoes? Was it 50 years ago, as I've been reading?
I thought it was, well, 2008 had a lot of tornadoes, and 2004 had a lot of tornadoes. I mean, it varies, because the record pace kind of bumps up and down, because if you have a big week of tornadoes, then there were a lot, then there's a quiet week, then there's a lot of tornadoes, then there's a quiet week. So it does, it varies which year is the record year that this is ahead of.
Mm-hmm. And is there any reason, can you study why we've seen more of these tornadoes that are hitting cities and towns where there would be more death and destruction?
No, having them hit cities and towns is really just bad luck. Towns are very small targets, so most tornadoes don't hit towns. They don't hit cities. Most tornadoes churn through open country or hit a few houses. This one, the damage we're looking at right now is in a pretty open area. I'm looking at a house which the whole second story has been ripped off, and there are a lot of trees damaged. But across the street is a huge open field, dozens of acres of open field. So while this tornado did damage, it didn't do as much as had it gone through the center of Guthrie, Oklahoma, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's really on the fringes of town. And fortunately, that's true most of the time. It's pretty open country. Anybody who's flown over the middle of the country or you fly over Wisconsin, you see that most of that area is woods and fields, things like that. The bad thing is that every once in a while, a tornado does go through a built-up area, does go through a city. In fact, the case with Joplin, Missouri was quite bad. It was a city of 50,000 people, so a medium-sized city. That's part of why it caused so many deaths.
We welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them in a moment. Our lines are all ringing here. Joshua Werman, president of the Center for Severe Weather Research in Boulder, Colorado, is joining us now. And he is in Guthrie, Oklahoma, looking at the damage from the tornado, one of the tornadoes that hit Oklahoma yesterday and into early this morning. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Starting our phone calls this half hour with Chris in Saratoga. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I'd like to have the speaker touch on the tri-state tornado and if the possibility exists of a tornado even more powerful than an F5. Thank you.
Sure. Well, I stepped into the wind here because we're looking around some damage. The tri-state tornado is infamous because it was the deadliest tornado ever, and of course it was many decades ago. And so it is possible to get a tornado which causes more deaths than that, unfortunately. even the Joplin, Missouri tornado from a few days ago is not the worst case. The Joplin tornado went through a relatively small city, 50,000 people. One could imagine that a tornado like that Joplin, Missouri tornado could have gone through St. Louis instead, or could have gone through suburban Chicago, or could have gone through suburban Atlanta. And in that case, there could have been tens of miles long of fairly dense neighborhoods that it went through, and conceivably could destroy many, many more houses. Sorry for the interruption there. I'm trying to get so I can charge my cell phone here.
Oh, okay.
So one can imagine worst cases that are worse than that. And, in fact, my group did a study back in 2007 where we took tornadoes like the Joplin tornado that we had wind measurements in from our Doppler and Wheels radars and asked the what-if question. What if that tornado had gone through suburban Chicago? What if it had gone through Long Island? What if it had hit those areas? And the results were quite horrific. Stand by 1 second. Now, in terms of whether a tornado can be stronger than EF5, in a technical sense, no, because the rating scale only goes up to EF5. So anything that has damage of a certain level or higher is called EF5. So there's no such thing as an EF6 or anything like that. The rating scale for tornadoes, strictly speaking, is not really a wind scale. Very rarely do we get wind measurements in tornadoes. Now, sometimes if I'm around with a Doppler on wheels and some of the tornadoes during some of their lifespans yesterday in Oklahoma, I got wind measurements. But that's relatively rare. So almost all the time, scientists, researchers have to go in after a tornado's happened, like I'm doing at this moment, and I'm looking at destroyed homes, and I'm looking at destroyed trees and other kinds of damaged fences that are down, and then we try to estimate what the wind speeds were based on that damage.
Hmm.
And that's what happened in Joplin. There were no wind measurements there. Researchers went in after the fact and were then looking at the amount of damage that happened and said, well, it took this much to do this type of damage. You know, so another amount of wind to probably do some other amount of damage.
And what did they come up with? Did they come up with 200 miles an hour? Is that what I heard yesterday in Joplin?
The last I've seen in Joplin was it was approaching 200. The last estimate I saw was 190 to 198, which frankly is more precise than those estimates are justified in making. I mean, we just don't have an understanding that has a five, you know, plus or minus 3% error bar, which is what they're implying. We're just not that accurate. It's like going, you know, outside with a thermometer and saying the temperature is 73.52. We don't know that accurately. Certainly, this tornado did quite high-end damage. Whether it was as strong as some other tornadoes, well, the detailed surveys will determine that. But even winds of that level, EF4 level, are certainly capable of causing such destruction that people living in those structures are at risk of dying. To some extent, it doesn't matter much to a person in a house that's destroyed, whether it was EF4 or EF5. Either one, from a practical point of view, is complete destruction. From a scientific point of view, sometimes we can tell subtle differences between, you know, destroyed and sort of, you know, big chunks and destroyed, and the big chunks are blown even farther away. But that's, in many cases, kind of an academic distinction.
Right.
In either case, a home is completely destroyed.
John in Glendale, hi.
Hello. I've heard it reported that there's been extreme melt-off of the Arctic ice cap in the summer seasons, and I'm just wondering to what extent that might affect not just the water level, but just how the water reacts in the oceans, the Atlantic.
Okay,
that's not a tornado question. It's sort of a more climatology question, an ocean current question. I can answer that not as a climate expert, but I know a fair amount about meteorology. When the ice melts, the melting ice is clean water. It's not salt water. So there's different amounts of density. And so if you have and you can affect the currents not only at the surface of the ocean, but deep ocean currents. Whether water stays low or whether it flows along the surface depends not only on its temperature, but also depends on how much salt is in that water. So big melt-off, if you had all of a sudden a sudden melt-off of Arctic or Antarctic ice, it would affect those currents. And I'm not sure that anybody really knows how those currents will change. There are certainly studies that are being made to try to see how that would affect ocean currents. Ocean currents are critical in many ways. Certainly they affect the climate. It's sort of well known, you know, the climate of England is fairly warm because the Gulf Stream eventually goes up over to Northern Europe. If you change that, then you would affect climate in different ways. And these ocean currents are also very important because they bring nutrients and around in the ocean and transport ocean creatures. And I'm being a little bit vague here because this is not my specialty. But yes, melting Arctic ice has important climatological implications.
Thanks, John, for the call. An email that's come in: when I was a kid back in the 70s and 80s, if you heard a tornado warning, you went immediately to the basement. Now with so many severe weather watches, severe weather warnings, thunderstorm watches, thunderstorm warnings, etc., I lose interest. I turn the TV off. I think in an effort to keep the public informed, the Weather Service has actually taken a step backward.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say we've taken a step backwards. I actually think that the increased warnings are a good thing. However, in our process of increasing the warnings, we've increased them from probably about 3 minutes average lead time to about 13 minutes lead time in the past few decades. That's a good thing. The false alarm rate of these warnings has also decreased. It used to be that 90, 95% of warnings were false alarms. Now it's only about 70 or 75%. However, with a 70% false alarm rate, I can understand why people might not always take the most drastic action when they hear a warning. Mm-hmm. And one of our major efforts is not only to increase that warning lead time, but to decrease the false alarm rate. Because we want people to really go to their basements. We want people to really go to interior rooms when they hear those warnings and not ignore them. And I haven't seen hard data yet, but certainly there are stories floating around about the recent tornadoes this spring that some of the people who were injured, some of the people who died might not have been in safe locations. They might not have heeded what, in this case, were actually pretty good warnings. Joplin had a warning about 20 minutes ahead of time, and we hope that everybody went and got to shelters. But I can certainly understand why people might not do that if it's difficult to do and they hear a lot of these warnings.
Bob is next. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning. So, my question is that it seems every time these, you know, tornadoes turn up, afterwards we hear the story or we see it on TV where there'll be two cars parked in a driveway and one is completely destroyed and the other one's sitting there untouched, or there'll be one house standing untouched and all the neighborhood is wiped out. And I'm wondering if there's any explanation for that. Thank you.
Well, tornadoes are small. And there's a very strong, what we call, gradient in the wind. So certainly one block might have winds that are 150 miles an hour, and if you move a few hundred yards away, maybe the winds are only 100 miles an hour, and there's a lot of difference in the damage. There might also be smaller-scale features, just turbulent whirls like you see whirling around buildings, which would make one particular house get a lot more wind than the other. But probably the biggest factor in very small difference, in big differences in damage over very small areas is the bad luck of something hitting one house or the other house, or something hitting one car versus the other car. And there's a lot of airborne debris in a strong tornado, and it's that debris that causes a lot of the damage. If you look at the photos of Joplin, you see a lot of trees that are just raked to their bark, and all the big branches are broken. Some of those were done by wind, but a lot of those were done by pieces of houses hitting the trees, which do a lot more damage than the wind. So a piece of house hits a tree at 150 miles an hour or hits a car at 150 miles an hour. That's the real hazard in many of these tornadoes. That's the biggest hazard in many of these tornadoes. And a lot of that's just luck, whether a piece of your neighbor's house hits one car and then it misses the next car.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Bob. George in Duluth. Hi, George.
Yes. You asked the previous meteorologist a question regarding tornado-proof housing, if such a thing existed and so forth, but the only thing you can find on the Internet, not quite the only thing, but what was mentioned was little concrete cubicles either outside or in the basement. However, having addressed this problem for about 30 years, it is a possibility of designing something that does not address single-family housing. It has to be done in a cluster. Otherwise, it's totally unaffordable. but it has to do with precast concrete, a curvilinear structure that would house at least 10 to 12 individual housing units with common features, and that aeronautically it can withstand 250-mile-an-hour winds, and especially the structural design has to be such that when you have a tremendous uplift that most tornadoes will pull up, to withstand that suction, for better, for want of a better term, you have to design the footings and the walls. Everything has to be like precast concrete. But the housing can be very livable. It can have some windows, but the windows have to be shuttered in such a way that they can be covered and closed with roll-down shutters, heavy metal shutters, not the typical type. And the thing is that what has prevented it for many years, in spite of outlays by both banks and insurance companies of over, last year was $1.3 billion, I mean, and it needs an investment, and banks don't like this type of housing because it's not a visible commodity.
Mm-hmm. Joshua, are you familiar with this kind of housing?
I said your caller, I think, is a good salesman. I almost want to buy one. but certainly it's possible to build structures which are tornado-proof. I mean, it's possible to build structures that are, you know, you bury them underground. They're nuclear bomb-proof. You can build very, very strong structures. But as the caller points out, affordability is an issue. And not everybody can afford those. If you take a look at lots of these neighborhoods that are destroyed, particularly in these Midwest High Plains communities, they're not wealthy communities. They're lower middle-class communities. Who can't afford the cost of building strong rooms, the cost of building individual storm shelters. Community storm shelters are an option for many of those communities, because then essentially the town is pooling its money together, or pooling its tax money together, and can build a strong shelter. And I think that's very good to do. The key there is that people have to have enough warning time that they can safely, you know, wake up their kids, get everybody dressed, or, you know, and run them out to that community shelter. The other issue, and this is more of a sociological factor, is that if you hear a tornado warning, and it's relatively easy to go to your basement, it doesn't disrupt your family's life that much to just go to the basement maybe for an hour until the storm passes. But bundling up the family and going, you know, half a mile down the street to the community shelter and then maybe staying there for hours is much more disruptive. And as we touched on earlier, will people do that? How good do the warnings have to be? How much time do they feel like they have to have? How much confidence do they have to have that the tornado really, really is coming, that it's not a false alarm, before they're willing to take that bigger step and get their whole family out of the house and down to the community shelter, which is a much more arduous thing to do? And I don't know that answer. But probably we have to have warnings better than they are now in order to make that a good choice all the time.
Thanks, George, for the call. And in the email, you mentioned the basement here. What is the safest place in the basement? Is under the stairs a good idea?
Sure. I think under anything is probably a good idea if it protects you from the collapsing house. I mean, you're in the basement. It's not the wind that's going to hurt you. It's basically things falling on you. And people aren't killed by wind. I mean, and I haven't looked at all the what the cause of fatalities were, for example, in Joplin, but I'm quite confident that you'll find most of those are crushing injuries, cutting injuries there because their houses fell down on them. And so if you can get under a table or under a stairwell, anything that's structurally really tough, and then in the basement, that's the safest place to be.
One more
or in an interior room. Now, I should point out, a lot of people out in Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma don't have basements. And it's probably unreasonable to expect everybody to invest to dig a basement. So those, you know, if they're in those kind of homes and they don't have time to seek a community shelter, then an interior room. They just want to be in the toughest, most protected place they can, cover their heads as much as they can, obviously cover children if they can. You know, the idea to prevent things from hitting you at high speed and to basically be in the best place you can if there is a structural collapse in the house you're in.
And Joshua, what's your assignment for today?
Well, yesterday we collected data in different tornadoes. We collected data in three of the tornadoes that happened yesterday. And we have radar data. We have three-dimensional maps of what the winds were and that we measure with the radar. And now we're going through and looking at the ground truth, what actually happened under our radar data, so we can then correlate what we saw in the radar data, the wind speeds we measured in the radar data, to particular damage. So I'm sitting right now in front of a house that's had its roof ripped off and a lot of damage. There's walls, walls are pretty damaged and windows are out and there's just debris all over the place. And what kind of wind did it take to do this? Well, I have radar measurements in this. So this is one of these rare cases where we have radar data and then we can go back and look specifically at the damage that happened. So we're going to be surveying two of those three tornadoes, and other groups are surveying other tornadoes. And we'll pool our knowledge together and hopefully make a little incremental increase in our knowledge of how exactly these winds are doing damage.
Thank you, Joshua, so much for being with us. Our guest, Joshua Werman, this half hour of the program, president of the Center for Severe Weather Research in Boulder, Colorado, joining us today just outside Guthrie, Oklahoma, where he's examining the tornadoes that struck there last night and early into Wednesday morning. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thank you for your calls and for listening.